Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing and improv and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting Yes And is Frederick DeBoer. Frederick is a writer and academic with a PhD from Purdue University. His writing has appeared in such places as the New York Times, Harper's, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, Politico, Playboy, New Republic, and Foreign Policy. He's one of the most original and prolific voices in essays today, and his anti-tribal style has earned him admiration from political thinkers of all quadrants. He has a new book, The Cult of Smart, How Our Broken Education System Perpetuates Social Injustice. I'm a prime target and a prime audience for this book. My wife is a college professor. We live in the city, but send our kids to private school. Our son just graduated from a liberal arts college with a degree in theater. We get our weekly CSA box of produce and donate to various liberal causes. We aren't anywhere near the 1%, but we are in the top, I guess, 20%. And this book seems to be talking to us in many ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think when America conceives of its vision of success, obviously we have, you know, the idea of like Lamborghinis and mansions, but I think that in a more general sense, I think we tend to think of, you know, the kind of hippie Park Slope parents who are comfortable, if not rich, and who are very sort of branded liberally. Or, you know, Echo Park or Lincoln Park or wherever, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that is a vision that has become very prominent in Americans' sort of self-conception, and I think it's important.
And you write, so this premise in the book, which you write, quote, "We use academic performance as shorthand for a person's overall human value." Mm-hmm. That seems like the big idea in this book, that we have decided that smart is it, and that ignores just such a huge swath of the human experience and human beings themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I've told this story like on every podcast I've done, so I apologize to anyone who's hearing it for the third time, but just a little slice of life indicative story, which is that I was at a cookout when I was getting my PhD at Purdue with a bunch of PhD students, a bunch of people from departments that were not mine, so I didn't really know them. Anyway, there was a family there, a Chinese family. The husband and father was a PhD student, and he was there with his wife and two kids. And the wife was bragging to a bunch of us about her older son's academic prowess, saying about how he was tops in everything in his class and how he was going to skip a grade, how he was in a robotics club, and which is, you know, doting mother stuff. You're very used to it. But then her younger son came running by making like funny noises with his mouth. And she said, this one is maybe not too smart. And I could feel the tension among these other people, these people who were there talking to her with me. I could see them sort of blanch for a minute. I could feel myself say, holy shit, you know? And that later on that day, I was sort of thinking about it. And, you know, I said to myself, why with smart do I immediately assume that something has gone wrong if you say your kid is not smart? Because if she had said that he does not have an artist's temperament, I wouldn't have cared.
Yeah.
If she has said he'll never be a great athlete, I wouldn't have cared. If she said he didn't have an ear for music, I wouldn't have cared. But when you call a kid not smart, there's a feeling that you're condemning that person, that you are condemning them to an unhappy, unsuccessful life. And it's that is at the core of what I'm trying to pick at in this book, is all the structures that we have in society and in our culture that tell our kids their value is only their academic value, and how destructive that is.
Yeah, there's social science around actually not telling people how smart they are in terms of the idea that you want to work through the problem and mistakes are good and it's how we learn. And so I think there's a lot of different kind of damage we're doing with that. So I try to listen either outside my bubble or bubble adjacent. So I'll occasionally listen to the Sam Harris Making Sense podcast. Okay. And sometimes I enjoy the conversations and other times I find them infuriating. But he had on Catherine Page Harden, who you quote in the book, and the topic was genetics. And I almost didn't listen because I find Harris's take on that matter to be racist, quite frankly. But Dr. Harden also finds his take deeply problematic. And so I listened to the episode, but just the idea, like just the idea of engaging with that material. And I was privately was like off-putting and I almost didn't do it.
So I want to say up front, and this has been a bit of a bone of contention, the heritability of intelligence is a scientifically contentious subject.
Yeah.
And I'm not a scientist, so I can't solve it.
Mm-hmm.
I find people like Harden to be persuasive. I also think that she's a good example of a very progressive person who does not believe in racist pseudoscience, but also believes that our genes influence our behavioral traits. Now, as I've told people, if you can't get past the genetic stuff, then just ignore it, because even without the talking about genes, the basic argument stands, right? So at its most basic, perhaps the most basic observation this book makes is to say, when we look at academics, we always see a distribution of ability. In any field of academic success, there's always a distribution, people who are at the extreme ends, people in the middle, and that has always been true and will always be true. And also further, we observe that, and there's plenty of exceptions, but in general, people stay in their ability band for most of their lives. To a remarkable degree, children sort themselves into high, low, medium at young ages, and they tend to stay there as they go along. Are there exceptions? Of course there's exceptions. But from a distance, from the policy perspective, that is true. So talking about genes and behavior, talking about genes and intelligence is always going to be contentious. As I say, I'm persuaded, and I tried my best in the book to accurately reflect other people's arguments, because again, I can't do original genetics research. But if you can't get past the genes, then just focus on the fact that we don't have any way to create educational equality, even if genes are not involved. In other words, suppose it's all environmental. Let's say that there's no student side factor at all, that everything that happens to a student academically is the impact of something that's happening in their environment. Does that therefore mean that we can change everything, the fact that it's environmental? No, of course not. There's tons of things that are out of our control. Here's a perfect example. So premature babies, so children who are the product of premature births, very low birth weight births, have, again, on average, a trend, but they have significantly negative impacts on their academic performance. Most people don't know that, but it is there are serious negative impacts on their academic performance from that fact. That's an environmental impact. It's not genetic, mm-hmm. But we still can't change it. And in fact, we're going in the opposite direction because as medical science improves, younger and younger and lower birth weight babies are able to be saved. So in fact, the problem is probably going to become bigger rather than smaller. So that's what I mean when I talk about environment not meaning something that we can control, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk a lot about teachers, and I'm married to one, and my neighbors are teachers, and that we're dumping on our teachers, essentially, is what this book is saying, is that and it's not fair in many ways because they can only do so much.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is nobody planned this. Like, nobody sat down and said, let's create a system where literally the sorting of winners and losers in the economy, the sorting of people into lives of comfort or lives that are lived on the edge and lived with poverty or you know, living on disability or whatever. Nobody said, let's invest all of that in our K-12 system. You know, no one ever said, let's make our education system the linchpin of our economy. But it became that anyway, right? I mean, it's a classic example of how economics dictates culture, right? So once we have this growing and growing importance of the education system, then we have the growing and growing sense in our culture that your value is only your academic value. So nobody would have, I mean, hopefully nobody would have said this is an intelligent thing to do to put so much pressure on our teachers, but it's just sort of what has happened. And if you have a bunch of people who, again, are distributed along the ability spectrum, right? That's what we've got. We've got people who are distributed on a ability spectrum like we would always expect. I mean, it should always be our expectation to find that. And you just can't move them. There's always going to be people who are performing below average by definition. And then you then say to the people who can't make the below average students above average, you know, we're going to destroy your union. We're going to institute merit pay, which is based on arcane formulas that are very difficult to demonstrate their efficacy. We're going to get rid of your tenure, et cetera. It's just a classic example of, you know, we've got a policy nail, and so we're looking for a policy hammer, right? Like we are insisting that this must be the problem because it's the only thing that we can affect. I belong to the school of thought that says that in their academic outcomes, the family impact is smaller than people assume. So this is, again, something from the genetics research, that the impact of the family is smaller than people assume. But let's assume that it's a large part. It's just for the sake of conversation. What are you going to do, right? If it turns out that it's the parents, are we going to start taking kids away from their parents if they don't score well on standardized tests? I mean, are we going to send monitors into the home? I mean, of course not, right? Mm-hmm. We don't talk about the parents and the family because there's no policy lever. Teachers are our policy lever. We control how much they get paid. We control if they have tenure. So we keep cranking that lever because it seems to be the only thing that we can do. And unfortunately, that is placing a burden of expectations on teachers that they can't possibly meet.
And this is not a right-wing thing, a left-wing thing. It's a both-wing thing for slightly different reasons, right?
Yeah, I think that there is a tradition of sort of the left-wing sort of defending teachers as public sector workers, and because of their unions, and teachers' unions have always been stalwart defenders of the Democratic Party. But there is also a neoliberal wing of in the United States political spectrum who are technocratic, who are very invested in using market-based models to solve all of their problems. And so what has happened in the K-12 space is more and more and more pressure to become a market-based mechanism. In other words, you have charter schools and you say, hey, if they perform, then And then people will flock to them and there'll be a market success. And then the other schools will have not have enough students and they'll close. And that's the basic charter school argument. I happen to think that the supposed gains of charter schools are largely due to a lot of chicanery, way of massaging who comes into the schools and so what their metrics look like. So, for example, Success Academy Charters here in New York has a sterling reputation, particularly among those neoliberals I mentioned before. But one of the things that doesn't get mentioned is that after third grade, Success Academy does not backfill, which means that from K through three, if students drop out, they will fill in those classes so that there's an adequate number of students for each class. But after that point, they no longer fill in classes, which means that you are removing students from the classroom. Well, what happens when you remove students from the classroom? Who's going to be the most likely to drop out of a K through 12 school? It's going to be a child who is in a unstable home, right? Uh-huh. There's people who are migratory, people who are in poverty, people who are living in shelters. The students who are likely to be removed from the population are those who are most likely to be hard to educate. And that's the kind of mechanism I'm talking about when I say there's a lot of chicanery.
You also you say, quote, selection bias is the first mover in education, the most powerful, most distorting influence, and almost no one talks about it. So dig into that for us.
I mean, one of the things that I say that pisses off parents is I always tell them, you probably have essentially no idea how good your kid's school is.
Yeah.
Parents always think that they know how good their school is, but it's close to impossible for you to know that, because there's a vast number of influences on who is getting into your kid's school and who's being systematically eliminated. So there's this, you know, here's a classic liberal sort of approach to education. Well, look, the good schools are in the suburbs and the poor schools are in the city. And if only we could send the kids from the city into the good schools in the suburbs, but they can't get in because they can't afford to live there. Uh-huh. So they get kept out of the good school. But a much simpler story than that is, in fact, the suburban school looks good precisely because it systematically eliminates poorer students, right? In other words, the arrow of causation is wrong. It's not that the school is better and just happens to exclude the poorer students. It is perceived to be better because it is excluding the poorer students. And if that's true, then that means that moving the poorer students into those schools is only going to bring problems from pile A to pile B. So, with private schools, it's also, you know, you have the clear sieve, a selection effect of people have to be able to afford to go to private school. And if they can't, then they don't go in. And socioeconomic status or a parent's income is a pretty strong predictor of how well kids do in school. Also, as I mentioned in the book, some schools actually have admissions tests before you can go to these private schools. And I went to a public high school in a city that also had a private boys' school and a private girls' school, high schools. And they would always brag about how well their students performed on standardized tests like the SAT. But of course, you had to pass a test to get into the school in the first place. So of course they're going to do well on schools. It's like having a height minimum for your school and then saying, look at how tall our student body is, right? Of course they're tall, right? So, yeah.
I thought there was an interesting section of the book where you were talking about algebra, and I was flashing back. I was not a great student in grade school, and it was really towards the end of high school that I started to hit my stride, and I did very well in college. Exact same thing for my son, who just graduated. But I could not do algebra for the life of me. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. And then I developed this sort of like, oh, I'm bad at math. And then it was funny because I ended up in a job where I do tons of math and just had to think about it differently. But I didn't get that in my schooling. And you actually point at that specifically as a place where people get caught up and really hurt with algebra in particular.
Yeah. I mean, it's, So I referenced Andrew Hacker and his book, The Math Myth, in the book. And that is a very eye-opening book about just how disabling, debilitating the effects of statewide algebra requirements can be. And we know that a predictor of dropping out of high school is failing classes. We also know that a predictor of dropping out of college is failing classes. And people come up against these math requirements. They can't pass them. And it creates just a severe negative pressure on their life. And, you know, he cites numbers like, you know, in 1 year in Arizona, 67% of students failed their algebra requirement. Yeah. And then you have some states that look like success stories, like New York, where some in the 70 percentile of students were passing their algebra requirement. But if you check under the fold, you find that, in fact, you passed if you got better than like a 33% on the test. So we have to see there are two approaches, right? You have the approach of, okay, fail them and they're in serious trouble, or let's lower the standard to the point of meaninglessness.
Yeah. I was looking for this quote that you have in the book, which is really nice, which quote, "Our system can promote equality or can sort people into hierarchy of ability. It can't do both." Yeah, this is just an ongoing problem.
Right. I mean, in the political arena, the constant drumbeat is the drumbeat of equality. In the book, I quote Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, I think Reagan, talking about school as an equalizer. In the policy world, school is seen as an equalizer. Then you get to high school and every kid you see is engaged in a, you know, white knuckled effort to prove that they're not equal to the other kids, right? Like,
yeah.
The entire process of getting into a selective college is talking about inequality. It's saying, I am not equal to these people. I am smarter than them. I do better activities than them. I'm a faster runner than them, whatever. And again, this system, this sorting system, plays an enormous role in our society. Suppose we actually got educational equality tomorrow. What would that even mean? And how would we, the whole system would collapse. Nobody would know what to do, how to sort people into different stations in life, how to sort people into colleges. Equality as a goal in education is just misconceived. It's kind of incomprehensible to me. And yet it is referenced again and again and again, particularly on the campaign trail.
And it's not like you're not anti-school. You're a teacher. This is not saying don't have school. It's saying we need to do school differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to the degree we can, let's let the air out of the balloon a little bit of making school a less competitive place, where we are less interested in constantly comparing students to their peers. Grades are a comparison to peers. SATs are a comparison to peers. The class rank is a comparison to peers. Your reading group in third grade is a comparison to peers. Mm-hmm. If we could instead just focus on cultivating what we can in every individual child and saying, okay, how can we enrich this life? What's something that we can do where we can help this person to live a fuller and happier life instead of constantly asking ourselves, but is he better than the kid sitting next to him? Now, there's big ways to do this and small ways to do this. I mean, part of the thing is the political side of the book is I want to reduce the stakes of the competition because those stakes can be so devastating. In other words, I want, through government intervention, I want to create a world where people are less subject to the whims of the schooling system. So if you can be someone who went into the schooling system and failed, which is fine, it happens to all of us. I never went a semester in high school without failing a math or a science class, and I usually failed both. If we can sort of create a world where the stakes are lower for this competition, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that we're going to wave a wand and get rid of competitive college requirements tomorrow. But what we can do is we can create a system in which students have more freedom to fail. in which students have more freedom to discover what they're not good at as well as what they are good at. A more school side specific way to do that is by loosening standards, right? Mm-hmm. Is by saying to students, you don't have to fit a cookie cutter mold of what we think a good student should look like. You don't have to have exactly the same kind of classes that your neighbor does, because you're not your neighbor. You are not the same person, and you have both have different strengths and weaknesses, and let's create a curriculum that plays to your strengths rather than constantly hitting you over your head with your weaknesses, which is the system that we have now. Unfortunately, with things like the Common Core, we're going in the complete opposite direction.
You said freedom to fail, and that comes up on this podcast constantly. Of course, from an improvisational context, that's what we sort of teach, because, you know, and you probably know this from the comedy world. It's like you get up and try out your material and you fall on your face and you have to get back up, and that's what you do over. And so you have to build this failing forward sort of muscle. But it's like scientists, marketers, CEOs, like the human condition is constantly running away from failure when it is embedded in the very way that we learn and grow and become a human being. How we flourish is through our failures.
Yeah. And, again, if you fail math and you find out that you are going to have to repeat the 11th grade, and so you therefore, out of shame and anger and frustration, you drop out of school.
Yeah.
We know for a fact that your odds of being the victim of a violent crime are higher. Your odds of being of committing a violent crime are higher. Your odds of becoming drug addicted are higher, etc. These are real high stakes stuff here. I mean, this stuff is really, really important. And so many of these wounds, I think, are inflicted by the system.
I was on Goodreads and reading some of the people making comments on the book. And you're a Marxist, and that sets off these alarms in people in terms of they just can't engage with the material because of that word.
I mean, I very consciously did not have a section in my book where I described the Marxist Revolution and what comes after.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a conscious decision to say, that's not going to be perceived as realistic by most people. Let's talk about things that are more achievable within the current American political spectrum. But I am a Marxist. I mean, you know, so again, like the culture following the economy is a Marxist idea, right? In other words, base determined superstructure is the term of art that people use. That's a Marxist idea. My Marxism informs everything in the book. But I have been getting some fairly good reviews in conservative places. The National Review gave me a positive review.
Yeah, they did.
And today the Wall Street Journal gave me as good of a review as I think the Wall Street Journal could. I'm not going to say that it was necessarily positive, but it was nice to see someone with an open mind about it anyway.
That's interesting. Yeah, we had Daniel Markovitz on to talk about his great book, The Meritocracy Trap. Which also, I think the one of the eye-opening things that's certainly happening now in this moment in our country is people recognizing, like, oh, it wasn't always this way, or we've been sort of walking around with this lie. And I found that certainly in this book, because we assume that it was always like this. We assume that going to college was always a thing that you were supposed to do, right? That's not how our country started out or necessarily is even an idea that old.
I mean, people, you know, are sometimes baffled that people can't think of a way that a worker could improve their station and could land themselves in a comfortable place without school. And so I say, well, look at the example of unions, right? Yep. Like the way right now that you become a well-paid worker is you have a credential, you go to school and you learn to do something and you get a credential for it. And you are able to differentiate yourself from your peers, from the other workers to do that, right? You say, hey, look, I have all the paperwork to show you that I'm qualified in this and I'm smarter than those other guys. And so if I'm a brilliant hacker or coder, you know, and I can prove it, then that's how I make my money, is that I am leveraging the ability that I have that my peers don't have, which of course, by its very nature is creates inequality, right? It has to. The basic mechanism has to create inequality. But if you look at unions, unions aren't based on that that principle. What unions are based on, they say, if we band together and we join our labor power as one and we make demands, we'll have the ability to secure a better life for ourselves because we'll shut the system down. We'll shut the business down. We'll prove to them that they can't function without us. And that collective bargaining power is used to raise the value of everyone in the union. Now, there are, of course, conservatives who will tell you that that's also that, you know, the union card just replaces the diploma, and we could talk about that. But there are other and have been other paths to the middle class lifestyle.
We end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they don't get very far. They don't get far at all by saying no. And they actually don't get that far by saying yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Yeah, I mean, not much of a story, but I, 2004, I think, I am 22 or 23, I'm fresh out of college. And I had begun the initial depressing work of applying for jobs, and it did not look particularly attractive to me. And a friend of mine had moved to Chicago. I was living in Connecticut at the time. And he said, why don't you come to Chicago and live here? And I said, yes, and. I said, yes, sir, I did. Because I had literally nothing tying me down. And I accomplished nothing in 2 years in Chicago. Other than really having a really good time. I mean, I did some heroic amounts of drinking and appreciated the city and made a lot of friendships and had a lot of memories. And so I cherish those years very much.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city in the summer. Yeah. I don't know about the rest of the year.
In the summer, yeah. It's nice.
The book is called The Cult of Smart, How Our Broken Education System Perpetuates Social Injustice. Freddie DeBoer, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it, Kelly.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.